he would take firm action. It did not work out that way. The light was fading on the second day when he reined in his pony on the edge of a clearing and inspected his new home. There was only one stone building, the chapel, in those days. Philip had built the new stone dormitory the following year. The other wooden buildings looked ramshackle. Philip disapproved. Everything made by monks was supposed to last, and that meant pigsties as well as cathedrals. As he looked around, he noted further evidence of the kind of laxity that had shocked him at Kingsbridge. There were no fences. The hay was spilling out of the barn door, and there was a dunghill next to the fish pond. He felt his face go tense with suppressed reproof, and he said to himself, "Softly, softly." At first, he saw no one. This was as it should be, for it was time for vespers, and most of the monks would be in the chapel. He touched the pony's flank with his whip and crossed the clearing to a hut that looked like a stable. A youth with straw in his hair and a vacant look on his face popped his head over the door and stared at Philip in surprise. "What's your name?" Philip said, and then after a moment's shyness he added, "My son."
"They call me Johnny Eightpence," the youngster said.
Philip dismounted and handed him the reins. "Well, Johnny Eightpence, you can unsaddle my horse."
"Yes, father."
He looped the reins over a rail and moved away.
"Where are you going?"
Philip said sharply.
"To tell the brothers that a stranger is here."
"You must practice obedience, Johnny. Unsaddle my horse. I will tell the brothers that I'm here."
"Yes, father."
Looking frightened, Johnny bent to his task. Philip looked around. In the middle of the clearing was a long building like a great hall. Near it was a small round building with smoke rising from a hole in its roof. That would be the kitchen. He decided to see what was for supper. In strict monasteries, only one meal was served each day, dinner at noon. But this was evidently not a strict establishment, and there would be a light supper after vespers, some bread with cheese or salt fish, or perhaps a bowl of barley broth made with herbs. However, as he approached the kitchen, he smelled the unmistakable mouth-watering aroma of roasting meat. He stopped, frowning, then went in. Two monks and a boy were sitting around the central hearth. As Philip watched, one of the monks passed a jug to the other, who drank from it. The boy was turning a spit, and on the spit was a small pig. They looked up in surprise as Philip stepped into the light. Without speaking, he took the jug from the monk and sniffed it. Then he said, "Why are you drinking wine?"
"Because it makes my heart glad, stranger," said the monk. "Have some. Drink deep."
Clearly they had not been warned to expect their new prior. Equally clearly they had no fear of the consequences if a passing monk should report their behaviour to Kingsbridge. Philip had an urge to break the wine jug over the man's head, but he took a deep breath and spoke mildly. "Poor men's children go hungry to provide meat and drink for us," he said. "This is done for the glory of God, not to make our hearts glad. No more wine for you tonight." He turned away, carrying the jug. As he walked out, he heard the monk say,
"Who do you think you are?"
He made no reply. They would find out soon enough. He left the jug on the ground outside the kitchen and walked across the clearing toward the chapel, clenching and unclenching his fists, trying to control his anger. "Don't be precipitate," he told himself. "Be cautious. Take your time." He paused for a moment in the little porch of the chapel, calming himself, then softly pushed the big oak door and went silently in. A dozen or so monks and a few novices stood with their backs to him in ragged rows. Facing them was the sacrist, reading from an open book. He spoke the service rapidly, and the monks muttered the responses perfunctorily. Three candles of uneven length sputtered on a dirty altar cloth. At the back, two young monks were holding a conversation, ignoring the service and discussing something in an animated fashion. As Philip drew level, one said something funny and the other laughed aloud, drowning the gabbled words of the sacrist. This was the last straw for Philip, and all thought of treading softly disappeared from his mind. He opened his mouth and shouted at the top of his voice, "Be silent!"
The laughter was cut off. The sacrist stopped reading. The chapel fell silent, and the monks turned around and stared at Philip. He reached out to the monk, who had laughed, and grabbed him by the ear. He was about Philip's age and taller, but he was too surprised to resist as Philip pulled his head down. "On your knees!" Philip yelled. For a moment, it looked as if the monk might try to struggle free, but he knew he was in the wrong, and as Philip had anticipated, his resistance was sapped by his guilty conscience. And when Philip tugged harder on his ear, the young man knelt. "All of you," Philip commanded, "on your knees!" They had all taken vows of obedience, and the scandalous indiscipline under which they had evidently been living recently was not enough to erase the habit of years. Half the monks and all the novices knelt.
"You've all broken your vows," Philip said, letting his contempt show. "You're blasphemers, everyone."
He looked around, meeting their eyes.
"Your repentance begins now," he said finally.
Slowly they knelt one by one until only the sacrist was left standing. He was a fleshy, sleepy-eyed man about 20 years older than Philip. Philip approached him, stepping around the kneeling monks.
"Give me the book," he said.
The sacrist stared defiantly back and said nothing. Philip reached out and lightly grasped the big volume. The sacrist tightened his grip. Philip hesitated. He had spent 2 days deciding to be cautious and move slowly, yet here he was with the dust of the road still on his feet, risking everything in a stand-up confrontation with a man he knew nothing about.
"Give me the book, and get down on your knees," he repeated.
There was the hint of a sneer on the sacrist's face.
"Who are you?" he said.
Philip hesitated again. It was obvious that he was a monk from his robes and his haircut, and they all must have guessed from his behavior that he was in a position of authority. But it was not yet clear whether his rank placed him over the sacrist. All he had to say was, "I am your new prior," but he did not want to. Suddenly it seemed very important that he should prevail by sheer weight of moral authority. The sacrist sensed his uncertainty and took advantage of it.
"Tell us all, please," he said with mock courtesy. "Who is it that commands us to kneel in his presence?"
All hesitation left Philip in a rush, and he thought, "God is with me, so what am I afraid of?" He took a deep breath, and his words came out in a roar that echoed from the paved floor to the stone-vaulted ceiling.
"It is God who commands you to kneel in his presence," he thundered.
The sacrist looked a fraction less confident. Philip seized his chance and snatched the book. The sacrist had lost all authority now, and at last, reluctantly, he knelt. Hiding his relief, Philip looked around at them all and said,
"I am your new prior."
He made them remain kneeling while he read the service. It took a long time because he made them repeat the responses again and again, until they could speak them in perfect unison. Then he led them in silence out of the chapel and across the clearing to the refectory. He sent the roast pork back to the kitchen and ordered bread and weak beer, and he nominated a monk to read aloud while they ate. As soon as they had finished, he led them, still in silence, to the dormitory. He ordered the prior's bedding brought in from the separate prior's house. He would sleep in the same room as the monks. It was the simplest and most effective way to prevent sins of impurity. He did not sleep at all the first night, but sat up with a candle praying silently until it was midnight and time to wake the monks for matins. He went through that service quickly to let them know he was not completely merciless. They went back to bed, but Philip did not sleep. He went out at dawn before they woke and looked around, thinking about the day ahead. One of the fields had recently been reclaimed from the forest, and right in the middle of it was the huge stump of what must have been a massive oak tree. That gave him an idea. After the service of prime and breakfast, he took them all out into the field with ropes and axes, and they spent the morning uprooting the enormous stump, half of them heaving on the ropes while the other half attacked the roots with axes, all saying, "Heave!" together. When the stump finally came up,
Philip gave them all beer, bread, and a slice of the pork he had denied them at supper. That was not the end of the problems, but it was the beginning of solutions. From the start he refused to ask the Mother House for anything but grain for bread and candles for the chapel. The knowledge that they would get no meat other than what they raised or trapped themselves turned the monks into meticulous livestock husbandmen and bird snarers, and whereas they had previously looked upon the service as a way of escaping work, they now were glad when Philip cut down the hours spent in chapel so that they could have more time in the fields. After 2 years, they were self-sufficient, and after another two, they were supplying Kingsbridge Priory with meat, game, and a cheese made from goat's milk, which became a coveted delicacy. The cell prospered, the services were irreproachable, and the brothers were healthy and happy. Philip would have been content, but the Mother House, Kingsbridge Priory, was going from bad to worse. It should have been one of the leading religious centres in the kingdom, bustling with activity, its library visited by foreign scholars, its prior consulted by barons, its shrines attracting pilgrims from all over the country, its hospitality renowned by the nobility, its charity famous among the poor. But the church was crumbling, half the monastic buildings were empty, and the priory was in debt to moneylenders. Philip went to Kingsbridge at least once a year, and each time he came back seething with anger at the way in which wealth, which had been given by devout worshippers and increased by dedicated monks, was being dissipated carelessly like the inheritance of the prodigal son. Part of the problem was the location of the priory. Kingsbridge was a small village on a back road that led nowhere. Since the time of the first King William, who had been called the Conqueror, or the Bastard, depending on who was speaking, most cathedrals had been transferred to large towns. But Kingsbridge had escaped this shake-up. However, that was not an insuperable problem, in Philip's view. A busy monastery with a cathedral church should be a town in itself. The real trouble was the lethargy of old Prior James. With a limp hand on the tiller, the ship was blown about at hazard and went nowhere. And, to Philip's bitter regret, Kingsbridge Priory would continue to decline while Prior James was still alive. They wrapped the baby in clean linen and laid him in a large breadbasket for a cradle. With his tiny belly full of goat's milk, he fell asleep. Philip put Johnny Eightpence in charge of him, for despite being somewhat half-witted, Johnny had a gentle touch with creatures that were small and frail. Philip was agog to know what had brought Francis to the monastery. He dropped hints during dinner, but Francis did not respond, and Philip had to suppress his curiosity. After dinner, it was study hour. They had no proper cloisters here, but the monks could sit in the porch of the chapel and read, or walk up and down the clearing. They were allowed to go into the kitchen from time to time to warm themselves by the fire, as was the custom. Philip and Francis walked around the edge of the clearing, side by side, as they had often walked in the cloisters at the monastery in Wales, and Francis began to speak. "King Henry has always treated the church as if it were a subordinate part of his kingdom," he began. "He has issued orders to bishops, imposed taxes, and prevented the direct exercise of papal authority." "I know," Philip said. "So what?" "King Henry is dead." Philip stopped in his tracks. He had not expected that. Francis went on. "He died at his hunting lodge at Lyon-la-Forêt in Normandy, after a meal of lampreys, which he loved, although they always disagreed with him." "When?" "Today is the first day of the year, so it was a month ago, exactly." Philip was quite shocked. Henry had been king since before Philip was born. He had never lived through the death of a king, but he knew it meant trouble and possibly war. "What happens now?" he said anxiously. They resumed walking. Francis said, "The problem is that the king's heir was killed at sea many years ago. You may remember it." "I do." Philip had been 12 years old. It was the first event of national importance to penetrate his boyish consciousness, and it had made him aware of the world outside the monastery. The king's son had died in the wreck of a vessel called the White Ship, just off Cherbourg. Abbot Peter, who told young Philip all this, had been worried that war and anarchy would follow the death of the heir, but in the event King Henry kept control and life went on undisturbed for Philip and Francis. The king had many other children, of course, Francis went on, at least 20 of them, including my own lord, Earl Robert of Gloucester, but as you know, they are all bastards. Despite his rampant fecundity, he managed to father only one other legitimate child, and that was a girl, Maud. A bastard can't inherit the throne, but a woman is almost as bad. "Did King Henry nominate an heir?" Philip said.
"Yes, he chose Maud. She has a son, also called Henry. It was the old king's dearest wish that his grandson should inherit the throne, but the boy is not yet 3 years old. So the king made the barons swear fealty to Maud."
Philip was puzzled. If the king made Maud his heir, and the barons have already sworn loyalty to her, what's the problem?
"Court life is never that simple," Francis said. "Maud is married to Geoffrey of Anjou. Anjou and Normandy have been rivals for generations. Our Norman overlords hate the Angevins. Frankly, it was very optimistic of the old king to expect that a crowd of Anglo-Norman barons would hand over England and Normandy to an Angevin, oath or no oath."
Philip was somewhat bemused by his younger brother's knowing and disrespectful attitude to the most important men in the land.
"How do you know all this?"
"The barons gathered at Le Neubourg to decide what to do. Needless to say, my own lord, Earl Robert, was there, and I went with him to write his letters."
Philip looked quizzically at his brother, thinking how different Francis's life must be from his own. Then he remembered something.
"Earl Robert is the eldest son of the old king, isn't he?"
"Yes, and he is very ambitious, but he accepts the general view that bastards have to conquer their kingdoms, not inherit them. Who else is there?"
"King Henry had 3 nephews, the sons of his sister. The eldest is Tybald of Blois, and there is Stephen, much loved by the dead king and endowed by him with vast estates here in England, and the baby of the family, Henry, whom you know as the Bishop of Winchester. The barons favoured the eldest, Tybald, according to a tradition which you probably think perfectly reasonable." Francis looked at Philip and grinned.
"Perfectly reasonable," Philip said with a smile. "So, Tybald is our new king."
Francis shook his head. "He thought he was, but we younger sons have a way of pushing ourselves to the fore." They reached the farthest corner of the clearing and turned. While Tybald was graciously accepting the homage of the barons, Stephen crossed the channel to England and dashed to Winchester, and with the help of baby brother Henry, the bishop, he seized the castle there and, most important of all, the royal treasury.
Philip was about to say, "So Stephen is our new ruler," but he bit his tongue. He had said that about Maud and Tybald, and had been wrong both times.
Francis went on. "Stephen needed only one more thing to make his victory secure, the support of the church. For until he could be crowned at Westminster by the Archbishop, he would not really be king."
"But surely that was easy," Philip said. "His brother Henry is one of the most important priests in the land, Bishop of Winchester, Abbot of Glastonbury, as rich as Solomon and almost as powerful as the Archbishop of Canterbury. And if Bishop Henry wasn't intending to support him, why had he helped him take Winchester?"
Francis nodded. "I must say that Bishop Henry's operations throughout this crisis have been brilliant. You see, he wasn't helping Stephen out of brotherly love."
"Then what was his motivation?"
"A few minutes ago I reminded you of how the late King Henry had treated the church as if it were just another part of his kingdom. Bishop Henry wants to ensure that our new king, whoever he may be, would treat the church better. So before he would guarantee support, Henry made Stephen swear a solemn oath to preserve the rights and privileges of the church."
Philip was impressed. Stephen's relationship with the church had been defined right at the start of his reign, on the church's terms. But perhaps even more important was the precedent. The church had to crown kings, but until now it had not had the right to lay down conditions. The time might come when no king could come to power without first striking a deal with the church.
"This could mean a lot to us," Philip said.
"Stephen may break his promises, of course," Francis said. "But all the same, you're right. He will never be able to be quite as ruthless with the church as Henry was. But there's another danger. Two of the barons were bitterly aggrieved by what Stephen did. One was Bartholomew, the Earl of Shiring. I know of him. Shiring is only a day's journey from here. Bartholomew is said to be a devout man. Perhaps he is. All I know is that he is a self-righteous and stiff-necked baron who will not renege on his loyalty oath to Maud, despite the promise of a pardon. And the other discontented baron? My own Robert of Gloucester. I told you he was ambitious. His soul is tormented by the thought that if only he were legitimate, he would be king. He wants to put his half-sister on the throne, believing that she will rely so heavily on her brother for guidance and advice that he will be king in everything but name. Is he going to do anything about it? I'm afraid so. Francis lowered his voice, although there was no one near. Robert and Bartholomew, together with Maud and her husband, are going to foment a rebellion. They plan to unseat Stephen and put Maud on the throne. Philip stopped walking, which would undo everything the Bishop of Winchester has achieved. He grasped his brother's arm. But Francis, I know what you're thinking. Suddenly all Francis's cockiness left him, and he looked anxious and frightened. If Earl Robert knew I'd even told you, he would hang me. He trusts me completely, but my ultimate loyalty is to the church. It has to be. But what can you do? I thought of seeking an audience with the new king, and telling him everything. Of course, the two rebel earls would deny it all, and I would be hanged for treachery, but the rebellion would be frustrated, and I would go to heaven. Philip shook his head. We're taught that it's vain to seek martyrdom. And I think God has more work for me to do here on earth. I'm in a position of trust in the household of a great baron, and if I stay there and advance myself by hard work, there's a lot I could do to promote the rights of the church and the rule of law. Is there any other way? Francis looked Philip in the eye. That's why I'm here. Philip felt a shiver of fear. Francis was going to ask him to get involved, of course. There was no other reason for him to reveal this dreadful secret. Francis went on. I can't betray the rebellion, but you can. Philip said, Jesus Christ and all the saints preserve me. If the plot is uncovered here in the south, no suspicion will fall on the Gloucester household. Nobody knows I'm here. Nobody even knows you're my brother. You could think of some plausible explanation of how you came by the information. You might have seen men-at-arms assembling, or it might be that someone in Earl Bartholomew's household revealed the plot while confessing his sins to a priest you know. Philip pulled his cloak closer around him, shivering. It seemed to have turned colder suddenly. This was dangerous, very dangerous. They were talking about meddling in royal politics, which regularly killed experienced practitioners. Outsiders such as Philip were foolish to get involved. But there was so much at stake. Philip could not stand by and see a rebellion against a king chosen by the church, not when he had a chance to prevent it. And dangerous though it would be for Philip, it would be suicidal for Francis to expose the plot. Philip said, What's the rebels' plan? Earl Bartholomew is on his way back to Shiring right now. From there he will send out messages to his followers all over the south of England. Earl Robert will arrive in Gloucester a day or two later and muster his forces in the West Country. Finally, Brian Fitzcount, who holds Wallingford Castle, will close its gates, and the whole of southwest England will belong to the rebels without a fight. Then it's almost too late, Philip said. Not really. We've got about a week, but you'll have to act quickly. Philip realized with a sinking feeling that he had more or less made up his mind to do it. I don't know whom to tell, he said. One would normally go to the Earl, but in this case he's the culprit. The sheriff is probably on his side. We have to think of someone who is certain to be on our side. The Prior of Kingsbridge? My prior is old and tired. The likelihood is that he would do nothing. There must be someone. There's the bishop. Philip had never actually spoken to the Bishop of Kingsbridge, but he would be sure to receive Philip and listen to him. He would automatically side with Stephen because Stephen was the church's choice, and he was powerful enough to do something about it. Francis said, "Where does the bishop live?" "It's a day and a half from here. You'd better leave today." "Yes," Philip said with a heavy heart. Francis looked remorseful. "I wish it were someone else." "So do I," Philip said feelingly. "So do I." Philip called the monks into the little chapel and told them that the king had died. "We must pray for a peaceful succession and a new king who will love the church more than the late Henry," he said. But he did not tell them that the key to a peaceful succession had somehow fallen into his own hands. Instead, he said, "There is other news that obliges me to visit our mother house at Kingsbridge. I must leave right away." The sub-prior would read the services and the cellarer would run the farm, but neither of them was a match for Peter of Wareham, and Philip was afraid that if he stayed away long, Peter might make so much trouble that there would be no monastery left when he returned. He had not been able to think up a way of controlling Peter without bruising his self-esteem, and now there was no time left, so he had to do the best he could. "Earlier today, we talked about gluttony," he said after a pause. "Brother Peter deserves our thanks for reminding us that when God blesses our farm and gives us wealth, it is not so that we should become fat and comfortable, but for his greater glory. It is part of our holy duty to share our riches with the poor. Until now we have neglected this duty, mainly because here in the forest we don't have anybody to share with. Brother Peter has reminded us that it's our duty to go out and seek the poor, so that we may bring them relief." The monks were surprised. They had imagined that the subject of gluttony had been closed. Peter himself was looking uncertain. He was pleased to be the center of attention again, but he was wary of what Philip might have up his sleeve, quite rightly. "I have decided," Philip went on, "that each week we will give to the poor 1 penny for every monk in our community. If this means we all have to eat a little less, we will rejoice in the prospect of our heavenly reward. More important, we must make sure that our pennies are well spent. When you give a poor man a penny to buy bread for his family, he may go straight to the alehouse and get drunk, then go home and beat his wife, who would, therefore, have been better off without your charity. Better to give him the bread. Better still to give the bread to his children. Giving alms is a holy task that must be done with as much diligence as healing the sick or educating the young. For this reason, many monastic houses appoint an almoner to be responsible for almsgiving. We will do the same." Philip looked around. They were all alert and interested. Peter wore a gratified look, evidently having decided that this was a victory for him. No one had guessed what was coming. "The almoner's job is hard work. He will have to walk to the nearest towns and villages frequently to Winchester. There he will go among the meanest, dirtiest, ugliest, and most vicious classes of people. For such are the poor. He must pray for them when they blaspheme, visit them when they're sick, and forgive them when they try to cheat and rob him. He will need strength, humility, and endless patience. He will miss the comfort of this community, for he will be away more than he is with us." He looked around once again. Now they were all wary, for none of them wanted this job. He let his gaze rest on Peter of Wareham. Peter realized what was coming, and his face fell. "It was Peter who drew our attention to our shortcomings in this area," Philip said slowly. "So I have decided that it shall be Peter who has the honor of being our almoner." He smiled. "You can begin today." Peter's face was as black as thunder. "You'll be away too much to cause trouble," Philip thought, "and close contact with the vile, verminous poor of Winchester's stinking alleyways will temper your scorn of soft living." However, Peter evidently saw this as a punishment, pure and simple, and he looked at Philip with an expression of such hatred that for a moment Philip quailed. He tore his gaze away and looked at the others. "After the death of a king there is always danger and uncertainty," he said. Pray for me while I'm away.
2. At noon on the second day of his journey, Prior Philip was within a few miles of the bishop's palace. His bowels felt watery as he got nearer. He had thought of a story to explain how he came to know of the planned rebellion. But the bishop might not believe his story, or, believing it, he might demand proof. Worse still, and this possibility had not occurred to Philip until after he parted company with Francis, it was conceivable, albeit unlikely, that the bishop was one of the conspirators and supported the rebellion. He might be a crony of the Earl of Shiring. It was not unknown for bishops to put their own interests before those of the church. The bishop could torture Philip to make him reveal his source of information. Of course, he had no right to, but then he had no right to plot against the king either. Philip recalled the instruments of torture depicted in paintings of hell. Such paintings were inspired by what went on in the dungeons of barons and bishops. Philip did not feel he had the strength for a martyr's death. When he saw a group of travellers on foot in the road ahead of him, his first instinct was to rein in to avoid passing them, for he was alone, and there were plenty of footpads who would not scruple to rob a monk. Then he saw that two of the figures were children, and another was a woman. A family group was usually safe. He trotted to catch them. As he drew nearer, he could see them more clearly. They were a tall man, a small woman, a youth almost as big as the man, and two children. They were visibly poor. They carried no little bundles of precious possessions, and they were dressed in rags. The man was big-boned, but emaciated, as if he were dying of a wasting disease, or just starving. He looked warily at Philip and drew the children closer to him with a touch and murmured word. Philip had at first guessed his age at 50, but now he saw that the man was in his 30s, although his face was lined with care. The woman said, "What ho, monk?" Philip looked sharply at her. It was unusual for a woman to speak before her husband did, and while monk was not exactly impolite, it would have been more respectful to say brother or father. The woman was younger than the man by about 10 years, and she had deep-set eyes of an unusual pale gold colour that gave her a rather arresting appearance. Philip felt she was dangerous. "Good day, father," the man said, as if to apologize for his wife's brusqueness. "God bless you," said Philip, slowing his mare. "Who are you?" "Tom, a master builder, seeking work." "And not finding any, I'd guess." "That's the truth." Philip nodded. It was a common story. Building craftsmen normally wandered in search of work, and sometimes they did not find it, either through bad luck or because not many people were building. Such men often took advantage of the hospitality of monasteries. If they had recently been in work, they gave generous donations when they left, although after they had been on the road a while, they might have nothing to offer. Giving an equally warm welcome to both kinds was sometimes a trial of monastic charity. This builder was definitely the penniless kind, although his wife looked well enough. Philip said, "Well, I have food in my saddlebag, and it is dinner-time, and charity is a holy duty, so if you and your family will eat with me, I shall get a reward in heaven, as well as some company while I dine." "That's good of you," said Tom. He looked at the woman. She gave the slightest of shrugs, then a little nod. Almost without pause, the man said, "We'll accept your charity and thank you." "Thank God, not me," Philip said automatically. The woman said, "Thank the peasants whose tithes provided the food." "Here's a sharp one," Philip thought, but he said nothing. They stopped at a small clearing where Philip's pony could graze the tired winter grass. Philip was secretly glad of the excuse to postpone his arrival at the palace and delay the dreaded interview with the bishop. The builder said that he, too, was heading for the bishop's palace, hoping that the bishop might want to make repairs or even build an extension. While they were talking, Philip surreptitiously studied the family. The woman seemed too young to be the mother of the older boy. He was like a calf, strong and awkward and stupid-looking. The other boy was small and odd, with carrot-coloured hair, snow-white skin, and protuberant bright blue eyes, and he had a way of staring intently at things,
with an absent expression that reminded Philip of poor Johnny Eightpence, except that, unlike Johnny, this boy would give you a very adult, knowing look when you caught his eye. In his way, he was as disturbing as his mother, Philip found. The Fairchild was a girl of about 6 years. She was crying intermittently, and her father watched her constantly with affectionate concern, and gave her a comforting pat from time to time, although he said nothing to her. He was evidently very fond of her. He also touched his wife once, and Philip saw a look of lust flash between them when their eyes met. The woman sent the children to find broad leaves to use as platters. Philip opened his saddlebags. Tom said, "Where is your monastery, father?" "In the forest, a day's journey from here to the west." The woman looked up sharply, and Tom raised his eyebrows. "Do you know it?" Philip asked. For some reason, Tom looked awkward. "We must have passed near it on the way from Salisbury," he said. "Oh, yes, you would have, but it's a long way off the main road, so you wouldn't have seen it, unless you knew where it was and went to find it." "Ah, I see," said Tom, but his mind seemed to be elsewhere. Philip was struck by a thought. "Tell me something. Did you come across a woman on the road, probably very young, alone, and, with child?" "No," said Tom. His tone was casual, but Philip had the feeling he was intensely interested. "Why do you ask?" Philip smiled. "I'll tell you. Early yesterday, a baby was found in the forest and brought to my monastery. It's a boy, and I don't think he was even as much as a day old. He must have been born that night. So the mother must have been in the area at the same time as you." "We didn't see anyone," Tom repeated. "What did you do with the baby?" "Fed him goat's milk. He seems to be thriving on it." They were both looking at Philip intently. It was, he thought, a story to touch anyone's heart. After a moment, Tom said, "And you're searching for the mother?" "Oh, no, my question was casual. If I came across her, of course, I would give the baby back to her, but it's clear she doesn't want it, and she'll make sure she can't be found." "Then what will happen to the boy?" "We'll raise him at the monastery. He'll be a child of God. That's how I myself was brought up, and my brother too. Our parents were taken from us when we were young, and after that the abbot was our father, and the monks were our family. We were fed, we were warm, and we learned our letters." The woman said, "And you both became monks?" She said it with a touch of irony, as if it proved that the monastery's charity was ultimately self-interested. Philip was glad to be able to contradict her. "No, my brother left the order." The children came back. They had not found any broad leaves. It was not easy in winter, so they would eat without platters. Philip gave them all bread and cheese. They tore into the food like starving animals. "We make this cheese at my monastery," he said. "Most people like it when it's new, like this, but it's even better if you leave it to ripen." They were too hungry to care. They finished the bread and cheese in no time. Philip had 3 pears. He fished them out of his bag and gave them to Tom. Tom gave 1 to each of the children. Philip got to his feet. "I'll pray that you find work." Tom said, "If you think of it, father, mention me to the bishop. You know our need, and you found us honest." "I will." Tom held the horse while Philip mounted. "You're a good man, father," he said, and Philip saw to his surprise that there were tears in Tom's eyes. "God be with you," Philip said. Tom held the horse's head a moment longer. "The baby you told us about, the foundling." He spoke softly, as if he did not want the children to hear. Have you named him yet?" "Yes, we call him Jonathan, which means a gift from God." "Jonathan." "I like that." Tom released the horse. Philip looked at him curiously for a moment, then kicked his horse and trotted away. The Bishop of Kingsbridge did not live at Kingsbridge. His palace stood on a south-facing hillside, in a lush valley, a full day's journey from the cold stone cathedral and its mournful monks. He preferred it this way, for too much church-going would get in the way of his other duties of collecting rents, dispensing justice, and manoeuvring at the royal court. It suited the monks, too, for the farther away the bishop was, the less he interfered with them. It was cold enough for snow on the afternoon that Philip arrived there. A bitter wind whipped across the bishop's valley, and low grey clouds frowned on his hillside manor house. It was not a castle, but it was nonetheless well defended. The woodland had been cleared for 100 yards all around. The house was enclosed by a stout wooden fence the height of a man, with a rainwater ditch outside it. The guard at the gate had a slovenly manner, but his sword was heavy. The palace was a fine stone house built in the shape of the letter E. The ground floor was an undercroft, its stout walls pierced by several heavy doors, but no windows. One door was open, and through it Philip could see barrels and sacks in the gloom. The other doors were closed and chained. Philip wondered what was behind them. When the bishop had prisoners, that was where they would languish. The short stroke of the E was an exterior staircase, leading to the living quarters above the undercroft. The main room, the upright stroke of the E, would be the hall. The two rooms forming the head and foot of the E would be a chapel and a bedroom, Philip guessed. There were small, shuttered windows like beady eyes looking suspiciously out at the world. Within the compound were a kitchen and a bakehouse of stone, as well as wooden stables and a barn. All the buildings were in good repair, which was unfortunate for Tom Builder, Philip thought. There were several good horses in the stable, including a couple of chargers, and a handful of men-at-arms were scattered around, killing time. Perhaps the bishop had visitors. Philip left his horse with a stable boy and climbed the steps with a sense of foreboding. The whole place had a distressingly military feel. Where were the queues of petitioners with grievances, the mothers with babies to be blessed? He was entering an unfamiliar world, and he was in possession of a dangerous secret. It might be a long time before I leave here, he thought fearfully. I wish Francis had not come to me. He reached the top of the stairs. Such unworthy thoughts, he told himself. Here I have a chance to serve God and the church, and I react by worrying about my own safety. Some men face danger every day, in battle, at sea, and on hazardous pilgrimages or crusades. Even a monk must suffer a little fear and trembling sometimes. He took a deep breath and went in. The hall was dim and smoky. Philip closed the door quickly to keep out the cold air, then peered into the gloom. A big fire blazed on the opposite side of the room. That and the small windows provided the only light. Around the fireplace was a group of men, some in clerical clothes and others in the expensive but well-worn garments of minor gentry. They were involved in a serious discussion, their voices low and businesslike. Their seats were scattered randomly, but they all looked at and spoke to a priest who sat in the middle of the group, like a spider at the center of a web. He was a thin man, and the way his long legs were splayed apart and his long arms draped over the arms of the chair made him look as if he were about to spring. He had lank, jet-black hair and a pale face with a sharp nose, and his black clothes made him at once handsome and menacing. He was not the bishop. A steward got up from a seat beside the door and said to Philip, "Good day, father. Who do you want to see?" At the same time a hound, lying by the fire, raised its head and growled. The man in black looked up quickly, saw Philip, and stopped the conversation instantly with a raised hand. "What is it?" he said brusquely. "Good day," Philip said politely. "I've come to see the bishop." "He's not here," the priest said dismissively. Philip's heart sank. He had been dreading the interview and its dangers, but now he felt let down. What was he going to do with his awful secret? He said to the priest, "When do you expect him back?" "We don't know. What's your business with him?" The priest's tone was a little abrupt, and Philip was stung. "God's business?" he said sharply. "Who are you?" The priest raised his eyebrows, as if surprised to be challenged, and the other men became suddenly quiet, like people expecting an explosion. But after a pause he replied mildly enough, "I'm his archdeacon. My name is Walleran Bygod." A good name for a priest, Philip thought. He said, "My name is Philip. I'm the prior of the monastery of St. John in the Forest. It's a cell of Kingsbridge Priory." "I've heard of you," said Walleran. "You're Philip of Gwynedd." Philip was surprised. He could not imagine why an actual archdeacon should know the name of someone as lowly as himself, but his rank, modest though it was enough to change Walleran's attitude. The irritated look went from the archdeacon's face. "Come to the fire," he said. "You'll take a draught of hot wine to warm your blood." He gestured to someone sitting on a bench against the wall, and a ragged figure sprang up to do his bidding. Philip approached the fire. Walleran said something in a low voice, and the other men got to their feet and began to take their leave. Philip sat down and warmed his hands while Walleran went to the door with his guests. Philip wondered what they had been discussing and why the archdeacon had not closed the meeting with a prayer. The ragged servant handed him a wooden cup. He sipped hot, spiced wine and considered his next move. If the bishop was not available, whom could Philip turn to? He thought of going to Earl Bartholomew and simply begging him to reconsider his rebellion. The idea was ludicrous. The Earl would put him in a dungeon and throw away the key. That left the sheriff, who was, in theory, the king's representative in the county. But there was no telling which side the sheriff might take, while there was still some doubt about who was going to be king. Still, Philip thought, I might just have to take that risk in the end. He longed to return to the simple life of the monastery, where his most dangerous enemy was Peter of Wareham. Walleran's guests departed, and the door closed on the noise of horses in the yard. Walleran returned to the fireside and pulled up a big chair. Philip was preoccupied with his problem and did not really want to talk to the archdeacon, but he felt obliged to be civil. "I hope I didn't break up your meeting," he said. Walleran made a deprecatory gesture. "It was due to end," he said. "These things always go on longer than they need to. We were discussing the renewal of leases of diocesan land, the kind of thing that could be settled in a few moments if only people would be decisive." He fluttered a bony hand as if to dismiss all diocesan leases and their holders. "Now I hear you've done good work at that little cell in the forest." "I'm surprised you know about it," Philip replied. "The bishop is ex officio, abbot of Kingsbridge, so he's bound to take an interest." "Or he has a well-informed archdeacon," Philip thought. He said, "Well, God has blessed us." "Indeed." They were speaking Norman French, the language Walleran and his guests had been using, the language of government. But something about Walleran's accent was a little strange, and after a few moments Philip realized that Walleran had the inflections of one who had been brought up to speak English. That meant he was not a Norman aristocrat, but a native who had risen by his own efforts, like Philip. A moment later this was confirmed when Walleran switched to English to say, "I wish God would confer similar blessings on Kingsbridge Priory." Philip was not the only one to be troubled by the state of affairs at Kingsbridge then. Walleran probably knew more about events there than Philip did. Philip said, "How is Prior James?" "Sick," Walleran replied succinctly. Then he definitely would not be able to do anything about Earl Bartholomew's insurrection, Philip thought gloomily. He was going to have to go to Shiring and take his chance with the sheriff. It occurred to him that Walleran was the kind of man who would know everyone of importance in the county. "What is the sheriff of Shiring like?" he asked. Walleran shrugged. "Ungodly, arrogant, grasping, and corrupt. So are all sheriffs. Why do you ask?" "If I can't talk to the bishop, I probably should go and see the sheriff." "I am in the bishop's confidence, you know," said Walleran with a little smile. "If I can help." He made an open-handed gesture, like a man who is being generous but knows he may be refused. Philip had relaxed a little, thinking that the moment of crisis had been postponed for a day or two. But now he was filled with trepidation again. Could he trust Archdeacon Walleran? Walleran's nonchalance was studied, he thought. The archdeacon appeared diffident, but in truth he was probably bursting to know what Philip had to say that was so important. However, that was no reason to mistrust him. He seemed a judicious fellow. Was he powerful enough to do anything about the rebellion? If he could not do it himself, he might be able to locate the bishop. It struck Philip that, in fact, there was a major advantage to the idea of confiding in Walleran. For whereas the bishop might insist on knowing the real source of Philip's information, the archdeacon did not have the authority to do that, and would have to be content with the story Philip told him, whether he believed it or not. Walleran gave his little smile again. "If you think about it any longer, I shall begin to believe that you mistrust me." Philip felt he understood Walleran. Walleran was a man something like himself, young, well-educated, low-born, and intelligent. He was a little too worldly for Philip's taste, perhaps, but this was pardonable in a priest who was obliged to spend so much of his time with lords and ladies, and did not have the benefit of a monk's protected life. Walleran was a devout man at heart, Philip thought. He would do the right thing for the church. Philip hesitated on the edge of decision. Until now only he and Francis had known the secret. Once he told a third person, anything could happen. He took a deep breath. 3 days ago, an injured man came to my monastery in the forest, he began, silently praying forgiveness for lying. He was an armed man on a fine fast horse, and he had taken a fall a mile or two away. He must have been riding hard when he fell, for his arm was broken, and his ribs were crushed. We set his arm, but there was nothing we could do about his ribs, and he was coughing blood, a sign of internal damage. As he spoke, Philip was watching Walleran's face. So far it showed nothing more than polite interest. I advised him to confess his sins, for he was in danger of death. He told me a secret. He hesitated, not sure how much Walleran might have heard of the political news. I expect you know that Stephen of Blois has claimed the throne of England, with the blessing of the church. Walleran knew more than Philip. And he was crowned at Westminster 3 days before Christmas, he said. Already? Francis had not known that. What was the secret? Walleran said with a touch of impatience. Philip took the plunge. Before he died, the horseman told me that his master Bartholomew, Earl of Shiring, had conspired with Robert of Gloucester to raise a rebellion against Stephen. He studied Walleran's face, holding his breath. Walleran's pale cheeks went a shade whiter. He leaned forward in his chair. "Do you think he was telling the truth?" he said urgently. "A dying man usually tells the truth to his confessor. Perhaps he was repeating a rumour that was current in the Earl's household." Philip had not expected Walleran to be sceptical. He improvised hastily. "Oh, no," he said. "He was a messenger sent by Earl Bartholomew to muster the Earl's forces in Hampshire." Walleran's intelligent eyes raked Philip's expression. "Did he have the message in writing?" "No." "Any seal or token of the Earl's authority?" "Nothing." Philip began to perspire slightly. "I gathered he was well known by the people he was going to see as an authorized representative of the Earl." "What was his name?" "Francis," Philip said stupidly, and wanted to bite his tongue. "Just that. He didn't tell me what else he was called." Philip had the feeling that his story was coming unraveled under Walleran's interrogation. "His weapons and his armor may identify him." "He had no armor," Philip said desperately. "We buried his weapons with him. Monks have no use for swords. We could dig them up, but I can tell you that they were plain and undistinguished. I don't think you would find clues there." He had to divert Walleran from this line of inquiry. "What do you think can be done?" Walleran frowned. "It's hard to know what to do without proof. The conspirators can simply deny the charge, and then the accuser stands condemned." He did not say, "especially if the story turns out to be false." But Philip guessed that was what he was thinking. Walleran went on, "Have you told anyone else?" Philip shook his head. "Where are you going when you leave here?" "Kingsbridge. I had to invent a reason for leaving the cell, so I said I would visit the priory, and now I must do so to make the lie true." "Don't speak of this to anyone there." "I shan't." Philip had not intended to, but he wondered why Walleran was insisting on the point. Perhaps it was self-interest. If he was going to take the risk of exposing the conspiracy, he wanted to be sure to get the credit. He was ambitious. So much the better for Philip's purpose. "Leave this with me." Walleran was suddenly brusque again, and the contrast with his previous manner made Philip realize that his amiability could be put on and taken off like a coat. Walleran went on, "You'll go to Kingsbridge Priory now and forget about the sheriff, won't you?" "Yes." Philip realized it was going to be all right, at least for a while, and a weight rolled off his back. He was not going to be thrown into a dungeon, interrogated by a torturer, or accused of sedition. He had also handed the responsibility to someone else, someone who appeared quite happy to take it on. He got up and went to the nearest window. It was mid-afternoon, and there was plenty of daylight left. He had an urge to get away from here and leave the secret behind him. "If I go now, I can cover 8 or 10 miles before nightfall," he said. Walleran did not press him to stay. "That will take you to the village of Bassingbourne. You'll find a bed there. If you set out early in the morning, you can be at Kingsbridge by midday."
"Yes."
Philip turned from the window and looked at Walleran. The archdeacon was frowning into the fire, deep in thought. Philip watched him for a moment. Walleran did not share his thoughts. Philip wished he knew what was going on in that clever head.
"I'll go right away," he said.
Walleran came out of his reverie and grew charming again. He smiled and stood up.
"All right," he said.
He walked with Philip to the door and then followed him down the stairs to the yard. A stable boy brought Philip's horse and saddled it. Walleran might have said goodbye then and returned to his fire, but he waited. Philip guessed that he wanted to make sure Philip took the road to Kingsbridge, not the road to Shiring. Philip mounted, feeling happier than he had when he had arrived. He was about to take his leave when he saw Tom Builder come through the gate, with his family in tow. Philip said to Walleran, "This man is a builder I met on the road. He seems like an honest fellow fallen on hard times. If you need any repairs, you'll be glad of him." Walleran made no reply. He was staring at the family as they walked across the compound. All his poise and composure had deserted him. His mouth was open and his eyes were staring. He looked like a man suffering a shock.
"What is it?"
Philip said anxiously.
"That woman."
Walleran's voice was just above a whisper. Philip looked at her.
"She's rather beautiful," he said,
realizing it for the first time. "But we're taught that it is better for a priest to be chaste.
Turn your eyes away, Archdeacon."
Walleran was not listening.
"I thought she was dead,"
he muttered. He seemed to remember Philip suddenly. He tore his gaze from the woman and looked up at Philip, collecting his wits. "Give my regards to the Prior of Kingsbridge," he said. Then he slapped Philip's horse's rump, and the animal sprang forward and trotted out through the gate, and by the time Philip had shortened his reins and got the horse under control, he was too far away to say goodbye. 3. Philip came within sight of Kingsbridge at about noon on the following day, as Archdeacon Walleran had forecast. He emerged from a wooded hillside and looked out across a landscape of lifeless frozen fields, relieved only by the occasional bare skeleton of a tree. There were no people to be seen, for in the dead of winter there was no work to do on the land. A couple of miles away across the cold countryside, Kingsbridge Cathedral stood on a rise, a huge, squat building, like a tomb on a burial mound. Philip followed the road into a dip, and Kingsbridge disappeared from view. His placid pony picked her way carefully along the frosted ruts. Philip was thinking about Archdeacon Walleran. Walleran was so poised and confident and capable that he made Philip feel young and naive, although there was not much difference in age between them. Walleran had effortlessly controlled the whole meeting. He had got rid of his guests graciously, listened attentively to Philip's tale, homed in immediately on the crucial problem of lack of evidence, swiftly realized that that line of inquiry was fruitless, and then promptly sent Philip on his way, without, Philip now realized, any guarantee that action would be taken. Philip grinned ruefully as he saw how well he had been manipulated. Walleran had not even promised to tell the bishop what Philip had reported, but Philip felt confident that the large vein of ambition he detected in Walleran would ensure that the information was used somehow. He even had a notion that Walleran might feel a little indebted to him. Because he was impressed by Walleran, he was all the more intrigued by the archdeacon's single sign of weakness, his reaction to the wife of Tom Builder. To Philip she had seemed obscurely dangerous. Apparently Walleran found her desirable, which might amount to the same thing, of course. However, there was more to it than that. Walleran must have met her before, for he had said, "I thought she was dead." It sounded as if he had sinned with her in the distant past. He certainly had something to feel.